My name is Judy and I'm an addict.
Hey.
Welcome to our Messages Hope Workshop of WCNA 31. Oops, I already got that part. Can we please open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I've asked Power to come up here and read what is the Narcotics Anonymous program. Is that right, Howard?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Howard. I'm an addict. What is the Narcotics Anonymous program? NA is a non-profit fellowship or society of men and women for whom drugs have become a major problem. We are recovering addicts who meet regularly to help each other stay clean. This is a program of complete abstinence from all drugs. There is only one requirement for membership, the desire to stop using. We suggest that you keep an open mind and give yourself a break. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. The most important thing about them is that they work. There are no strings attached to NA. We are not affiliated with any other organizations. We have no initiation fees or dues, no pledges to sign, no promises to make to anyone. We are not connected with any political, religious, or law enforcement groups and are under no surveillance at any time. Anyone may join us, regardless of age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, or lack of religion. We are not interested in what or how much you used or who your connections were, what you have done in the past, how much or how little you have, but only in what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. The newcomer is the most important person at any meeting because we can only keep what we have by giving it away. We have learned from our group experience that those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean.
Thanks, Howard. And we've asked Dave J. to read Why Are We Here?
My name's Dave, I'm not it. Why are we here? Before coming to the fellowship of NA, we could not manage our own lives. We could not live and enjoy life as other people do. We had to have something different, and we thought we had found it in drugs. We placed their use ahead of the welfare of our families, our wives, husbands, and our children. We had to have drugs at all costs. We did many people great harm, but most of all we harmed ourselves. Through our inability to accept personal responsibilities, we were actually creating our own problems. We seemed to be incapable of facing life on its own terms. Most of us realised that in our addiction we were slowly committing suicide, but addiction is such a cunning enemy of life that we had lost the power to do anything about it. Many of us ended up in jail or sought help through medicine, religion and psychiatry. None of these methods were sufficient for us. Our disease always resurfaced or continued to progress until in desperation we sought help from each other in Narcotics Anonymous. After coming to NA, we realised we were sick people. We suffered from a disease from which there is no known cure. It can, however, be arrested at some point and recovery is then possible.
Okay, thanks, Dave. At this time, I would like to introduce our speaker, whom I've just met. I have the honor and the pleasure of introducing Sean T. from the United Kingdom.
My name's Sean, I'm an addict. Not very good with microphones, so is this about the right? Is that all right? Yeah. You know that thing where you say to yourself, what's the worst thing that can happen to you before you're going to share? I did get an insight into that a couple of years ago. It was a work thing, not an NA thing. It was this conference in London. There were lots of people there I wanted to impress, these psychiatrists, these psychologists. And I got up to do this, and I had a mic in front of me like this. And I got about 2 or 3 minutes into it, and I thought, I can't hear my own voice, and I feel a bit strange what's happening. And I fainted. And I caught my head on the podium on the way down and just made a complete crap for myself in every sense. So the difference today is that I'm among friends. So if I fall over, I'm assuming one of you will come forward and pick me up. Mike will do that for me. And if I need to sit down, I'll sit down. But it is a real pleasure, a real honour to be here. What I get when I'm walking around this convention in terms of energy and diversity and recovery is just a miracle. It's a real privilege to be here. And so I'd like to start by thanking the committee and everybody who's doing service here and the people at the World Services for putting this on, because I know that putting on an event like this isn't actually that easy, and convention service is never very easy, is it? I sat on a few convention committees. It's quite task orientated, there's a time limit, everybody judges you for the end result. So thank you, everybody who's kind of taken that risk in their service and has put their energy into this. And I guess the other thing that's probably at the back of a lot of people's minds is what's happening elsewhere. I mean, probably like a lot of you, I've been in my hotel room and I've been watching the images of just appalling suffering for people who are affected by the flood, and I've been looking at that, and I've been going outside, and I've been on the beach, and I've been thinking, how do we make sense of this? How do we make sense of the fact that those human beings are undergoing that, and we're here, and we're in the sunlight? So I kind of, I don't know how you feel about this, but I'd just like to start, if we just take a few seconds and send those people a bit of our energy and a bit of our love and ask for their protection. Thanks for that. Because I guess watching those people, watching what they are needing to do in order to survive at the minute, what it's brought home to me again is somehow we have to make sense of our life on this planet, and it's an inexplicable mystery. We live, we die, we have to come to terms somehow with what exists in the middle. And for me, if I hadn't heard the Narcotics Anonymous message of hope, I would have just used drugs till I died, because for me, the use of drugs and my addiction was my means of escaping my humanity, was my means of escaping suffering. And I guess it seems to me that all of my life, that 20 years of using, was just focused on that desire to escape. And the other thing I'm struck by here is, I mean, I come from Britain, I come from a very small part of the fellowship in northeast England, and the area that I do service at is about 100 miles long, 75 miles wide. And in that area, despite the fact that we've just had an intensive period of growth over the last few years, there are maybe 28 meetings. So there's a lot of towns there, and even cities, where there are people who are living and dying with their addiction who don't have the luck to walk into a room full of people like you and get this message of hope, who haven't yet had that great joy come to them. And I suppose the other thing I was thinking is, I mean, walking around here, everything looks so well organised, doesn't it? It looks so self-assured. It would be very easy to stand back from it and think, this doesn't need me in order to survive. This fellowship doesn't need me to put anything into it at all. Look, there's lots of other people kind of doing it for me. Where I recover, I really don't have that luxury. We know that unless we do it, there won't be anybody else to do it. And my personal belief is that everybody that sits in this room today is absolutely crucial to the continued growth and strength of this fellowship. And we've all been given this fantastic gift. We've all been given this message of hope. We can all go and say to another addict, a using addict, you don't need to die of this disease. And that's a real privilege, I think. I mean, the other thing I feel, to be completely frank, is I feel a bit bewildered, I feel a bit disorientated. It was a long flight to get here. This is the longest journey I've made in my life, in more senses than one. And the last thing I did before I left my house was turn off the central heating, because although it's August in Britain, it's still cold. So I got here on Sunday night in my jeans and my boots and my winter vest and my jumper and my jacket. And I walked out of the airport and I thought, oh my God, what's going on here? It's night and it's still warm. And I've really had that sense of walking along the beach, walking under that blue sky, seeing that amazing ocean out there, and that sense of I've been spared to enjoy this when so much of my life was lived in the darkness and lived in despair. I can't have been spared for this for no reason. It must be for something. And for me, I think that's to carry our message. I'm just going to briefly touch on my using. I know it's a bit boring, we've all done it, we all know what it entails, but unless you kind of go back and revisit that stuff, you don't really have a sense of where you've come from. And I used for 20 years. The first time I got drunk, I was 11. And paradoxically, what I remember feeling at that point was I discovered a great source of hope, because I discovered the thing that was going to make my life on planet Earth possible. I discovered the thing that was going to make the pain, the fear, the shame, the difficulty and the suffering of being human go away. And I took that and I ran with it, and very quickly I was addicted to lots and lots of drugs. It doesn't really matter which drugs, does it? I mean, personally, I like the drugs that made me unconscious. I liked not being in my body. I liked not being conscious of my body. I saw my body as a kind of means for people to harm or to hurt me. So I liked to be as little present in it as possible. There was another kind of hope in my addiction that wasn't realised, and that was that the use of drugs would somehow reveal something to me important about what it was to be human. And so to that end, in the first few years, I also took truckloads of the drugs that, you know, make you have hallucinations and so on, with the belief that if I pushed myself through the process of sanity and I came out the other side into madness, something very important would be illuminated for me about what it is to be human. And that was, yeah, somebody else has tried that method. Did it work for you? It really didn't work for me. It was a total dead end. But the majority of my using really was very repetitive, very boring. People tend to leave that out, don't they? Just mind-numbingly boring and touched by the presence of death. Nearly all of my contemporaries that I used with are now dead, and they died of a variety of things. They died of HIV. When I started injecting, we didn't know about HIV. Hepatitis C was a gleam in some lab technician's eye. Nobody had heard of either disease. So they died of that. They died of septicemia. They died of overdose. They died of the casual kind of violence that goes with the street. And sometimes I think they died because they had no hope. They'd just lost hope. I'm thinking about, I don't know, I haven't thought about this woman for years. I had a friend in London called Delia, very gentle, kind of intelligent, nice woman. And what it said on her death certificate was that she died of heart failure as a result of septicemia because of her injecting. What she actually died of was because she'd lost hope. And I saw that light fade from her eyes in the last few months of her life. She'd lost any hope that there was something better for her than she knew, which was the daily life of a using addict. She died because she hadn't heard our message. And she died in a city where there's more NA meetings in the UK than there are anywhere else. So as we sit here and we kind of are with each other and we survived, and that's something to be celebrated above everything else, what I've also got in my mind, and I know this is a bit of a kind of bleak thought, but it is the truth, is that there's somebody dying out there because they haven't heard this yet. Yeah, what can I say? Using a ship, and all the stuff that happens to you when you haven't got, when you're outside of a social contract somehow, when you're on the street, happened to me. It's what happens outside of this fellowship is that the strong tend to prey on the weak, and so all of the stuff that goes with the street, like being beaten or being raped, being imprisoned, also happened to me. And I guess I'm not the only person in this room to have had those experiences. One of the things I really love about Narcotics Anonymous is that we turn that on its head. You go anywhere else, you go to any business or you go to any political forum, the most important person in any room is the most important person. Here, the most important person in any room is the most fragile, is the most vulnerable, is the newcomer. And I think in that we've created something that is fantastically special, because it doesn't really happen anywhere else. Very, very last bit of my using, I want to mention my mum. Hope you don't mind, guys. I kind of find myself returning to my relationship with my mum a lot. I really love my mum. I adored her. She was my favourite person. She's very loving, very generous, very kind, very optimistic. I'm Welsh, and the Welsh have got this saying, Mangwyn Mandroi, which means white place up ahead, which means kind of something good is about to happen. And despite the fact that she'd had a very difficult life, and a lot of very hard things have happened to her. She never lost her ability to have faith in other human beings, and she never lost her sense that something good was going to happen. In the last 10 years of my using, she got diagnosed with breast cancer, and she didn't get very competently treated, and she went about 5 years, I guess, from that diagnosis to her death. And in that 5 years, we tried everything that we could think of to prolong her life. We went to all the oncologists, we went to all the faith healers, we met some really loopy people, but none of it worked. And the kind of terrible irony for me looking back on that is that this was a human being that I loved the most and the bestest and the most deeply. And I was trying to be there for her, but I was also a using addict. So in that 5 year period, I was also in prison for supply for some of the time. As she was seeking life, I was on a daily basis shooting a kind of slow motion suicide into my veins. Well, not into my veins, because I'd run out of them by then, but I was working against the purposes of life. And in that last day of her life, when I was with her in the hospice, and she lost consciousness, and so it was just the sound of her breathing, I was with her, and I begged her to die. I begged her to let go and just swim in the warm, deep ocean, because I wanted her to be free of pain. I wanted her to be free of suffering. And then she dies. She died about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I left that place, I walked out of that hospice, and I stood in this beautiful summer's morning, blue sky above me, and what was left of my hope was extinguished, because I just watched the person I love best go, and I hadn't been able to be there for them in the true sense. I was there for them, her physically, but I was so full of drugs, I couldn't say I was there for her in any true sense, and I was living in a state of spiritual despair, and that's not a strong place to give anybody any hope from. So the very last bit of my using, I'm going to shut up about my using just 1 minute, was living without hope, and living without the knowledge that there was an alternative to that. I'd never seen any recovering addicts. I'd seen people who became dependent on alcohol rather than opiates, or I'd seen people who had been swallowed up by some weird cult, but I'd never seen anybody recover with that kind of dignity and self-respect and honour that we get in Narcotics Anonymous. So the last bit of my using was living like an animal in a cage in a very small bit of one room in a bit of a house, lying on a bed, waiting for drugs to come, getting up, trying to find a vein, going back to that bed. And then, my then partner on a Sunday afternoon was trying to find some money so we could get a bag, so we could stave off the withdrawal. I don't know what it's like in your part of the world, but in the UK, Sunday is just a really crap day to have a habit. You know, it's just, by anybody's standards, Sunday is a bad day to be a using addict. All the shops are shut, all the chemists are shut, there's no doctors you can hit, there's nobody to steal from. It's just not a good day. So he was going around, knocking on the neighbour's door, and this one bloke asked him in for a cup of tea. And presumably, because he thought he was going to get some money at the end of it, he went in. And this guy turned out to be someone who was in recovery, not in this fellowship, but understood the process of recovery. And he talked to him about it. And my then partner came back and came into our house, and he went into a room in the house that we didn't use, where the bookshelves were, and he reached up to the bookshelf, and he took down a book. And it was a book that had sat on his bookshelf for 10 years. He'd never got more than 4 pages into it because it didn't make any sense to him. Somebody had given it to him because they knew he had a serious problem with drugs. It had a blue cover. That book is why I'm alive. That book is why I'm here in this room with you. That book was our basic text. That book was our message of hope to addicts worldwide, that there is an alternative to living and dying a using addict. He read that book, and he tried to talk to me about it, and I went, because I don't think so. And he rang the helpline, and he found out where our nearest NA meeting was, and it was 50 miles away. We live in a small Suffolk town on the east coast of England. So he drove the 50 miles to that meeting. There was one meeting a week in that city then, and then he drove back, and he did that several times. And eventually he managed to get me out of the house to go to one. That wasn't easy because I was very agoraphobic by that point. I was kind of teetering on madness and I found it very difficult to go outside. And all the sort of normal human functions like washing or changing your clothes had gone. So you really wouldn't have wanted to sit next to me on a bus. I was pretty smelly. So he took me to this NA meeting. And I have to tell you, my first NA meeting, I don't remember a word of it. I sat there with my head on the table and I drooled throughout all of it. What I do remember was this very nice, attractive, well-dressed blonde woman coming up to me at the end of it and saying, keep coming back, you're in the right place. And that really surprised me. Nobody said to me anymore, keep coming back. What they tended to say was, never darken my doors anymore. For very good reasons. And you know, that woman was very kind to me. I was a using addict. She'd never seen me before. She didn't know me from Adam. She offered to have me in her house to detox. I mean, I went there. I lasted an hour and a half before I made the rescue me phone call. But the point was, she was prepared to reach out to somebody with whom there were no guarantees, who could have robbed away her video and TV. She was prepared to reach out. And I think two of the greatest gifts that NA have given me has been the gift of remembering and the gift of identification. Now, ask anybody who knows about the human brain, and they'll tell you that what we're programmed to do is forget pain. Presumably, this is nature's way of making sure that one morning we don't all wake up and collectively slash our wrists. But anyway, we are designed to forget pain. If I don't have a program of recovery, I forget the pain I'm using, and I use again. The gift of identification is a really precious gift. Because ever since that first woman said to me, keep coming back, you're in the right place, throughout all the hundreds of meetings I've sat through, I've never not seen the newcomer come in the door, dirty, dependent, despairing, mad, and not seen myself. Because that's exactly how I was when I came in. I had nothing, and I was given everything. And that's a great gift. When I came in through the treatment door, I ended up going to a 12-step treatment centre, which was a real piece of luck in the UK. There aren't that many 12-step treatment centres, and funding for them is actually quite hard to get. And I ended up, you know, having therapy and all that stuff. And that was useful to me, but I have to say, for me, the dynamic means of change hasn't been treatment, hasn't been therapy, it's been the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. And in that step one, I found a great paradox waiting for me, that to become free, I had to accept that I'm unfree. There are limitations to what I can do. I have a physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual disease. Physically, I can't control my use of drugs, whatever cocktail I try and use. Mentally, I am prone to obsessive, repetitive, negative thinking. If I don't have a program to stand between me and that, I live in a small cage. And I know what that looks like, because my oldest brother has this disease, but he hasn't used for a long time, doesn't have a program of recovery. What he has instead is an obsessive compulsive order to kind of keep him feeling that there is some element of control left in his life. And his life is a small cage of resentment and of fear, and it's not an attractive place to be. Abstinence without recovery, to me, looks like a very cold country. I don't want to go there. Emotionally, I have a disease which means that my feelings tend to be pride, resentment and fear, the holy trinity of my main character defects. Without a program, I'm left completely alone. Spiritually, and I'm really hoping I'm not alone with this, I'm completely self-centered. Is there anybody else here that is completely self-centered? Thank you. What a kind thing to do. I'm not alone with this. How fantastic. Yep. Complete and utter monstrous selfishness is my nature unless something intervenes. And for me, the thing that's really done that has been the process of service. In service, I've had a chance to transcend myself, to forget myself, to work for the greater good. And somebody gave me a nice image for that at the start of my recovery. They said it was like this mountain lake, you know, the rain fell on the mountain, and it was this beautiful, clear streams ran into this lake. And this lake was full of clear, sparkling, pristine water. And it was all the good things that you got from the steps. You get to save your life. You get to renew your relationships. You get to become healthy in many different ways. But unless there's an outlet from that lake, unless there's a stream moving out of it as well as feeding into it, that water becomes dark and stagnant and stale. And I think that's certainly true to my experience. And we sum that up with that you've got to give it away to keep it. Another great spiritual paradox. We give it away, we get more back, which is pretty neat, really, isn't it? When I started going to meetings, I was met with great generosity, great kindness, great openness. People opened their hearts to me. People told me how they'd got clean, how they stayed clean. I got some service and I got a sponsor. But it wasn't a perfect fellowship that I came to. I started recovering in this town in Brighton, in England called Brighton on the south coast. A couple of meetings a day there. Most of the people in them were great, were lovely. But there was one kind of quite vicious clique of people, of men, as it turns out, who were systematically preying on the newcomers. And I'm not talking about making a mistake because your head is turned. I've made enough mistakes in my recovery to have learned from them. I'm not talking about just acting out on impulse when you don't know better. I'm talking about people who systematically preyed on people who were more vulnerable. And that really left me with some quite difficult decisions, because one of the other things that I was struggling with in early recovery was all the post-traumatic stuff. So I had lots of nightmares and flashbacks and panic attacks, all the stuff that goes with that. And I had to ask myself, is this fellowship where I belong with these people? Do I choose to remain here with these people that in another branch of my life I wouldn't walk down the same street as? But you see, by that point, what I'd come to believe was I needed NA meetings in order to survive. So my decision was to stay and to try and work with others to create a culture where the weak, where the fragile, where the vulnerable are protected. So I got a group service representative position, I went to the area, started going to the region, became involved in NA service on lots of different levels. And on every level within that service structure, what I encountered were people who were working for the greater good, people who were working to carry this message of hope to other addicts. And that was the antidote to those few kind of very unpleasant individuals. The antidote was to see people working together to carry this message. And if there's anybody in the room who is in early recovery or in later recovery and is trying to work through that trauma stuff and has any of those symptoms, I just want to share with you that for me, although the first couple of years were very difficult with the post-traumatic stuff, it's really faded, it's really changed. I just needed to work the steps and be patient with myself and allow the process to happen. And I have healed beyond my wildest expectations. I think that's partly because I've come into a fellowship that is so incredibly, mysteriously diverse. I mean, I know when I first looked at step three, when, like many people, I had worries about the language that was used. Absolutely no disrespect to anybody that worships within any particular church, but I'm not a part of any organised religion, and organised religion has never done it for me. Really, I come from a Welsh Baptist background, and I've always wanted to stay away from what I saw in my childhood, I guess. But what I found at the heart of that step three was a programme that was so fluid and so capable of letting me be myself. I could bring whatever I chose to that step and have it work for me. And that my relationship with my higher power is the most important relationship in my life, and it's the wellspring from which all my other relationships with friends, with family, within the fellowship spring. And that's a great joy to me. Then if there's anybody in the room who is currently working on a step four, anybody in the room who has put a step forward down because it's just like loads of work and writing things down? Oh, thank you for putting your hand up. I think that was brave. I just want to, it is loads of work, there's no two ways about it. But I just want to kind of say to people that if you can get over that hump of writing all the bloody stuff down, there's such a great freedom in all the steps, but in that particular step, because you get to face your light and you get to face your shadow and you get to accept both. And there's stuff in the steps that I could just never, ever have predicted. I mean, I guess for me, that kind of suffering thing, my mind's back with those people in that flood and what they're having to undergo, and the people that I've watched suffer. When I came into recovery, I kind of thought that there was an exemption clause somewhere, that if you came into recovery, you did the right thing, you got a sponsor, you did got service, went to loads of meetings, you would be exempt from really profound suffering. And of course, this was a mistake, you know. But what I guess I've been shown in NA is that you can suffer with dignity and you can suffer with honour. I've watched people in this program die of cancer and keep their dignity as recovering addicts. I've watched people's courage and persistence in ways that have just absolutely awed me. And I guess I've had my own struggle with that. I was very ill for years in my recovery. Had this combination of hepatitis C and a genetic kidney disease that really made me very poorly for ages, and also brought me up against my own mortality, brought me up against who do I want to be when I grow up, what really matters to me, what's actually important here. And when I got right down to it, my needs were very simple. They were very straightforward. I just wanted to be able to live with love, to be able to live with some honour, to carry the message to the addict that still suffers. And that was all really, when you got right down to it, that I needed. But I needed this program to show that to me. I needed this program to show me that suffering is normal. It's a normal part of the human condition. All you have the choice over is how you respond to it. And I don't know about you, but when I go into the rooms, it's not about being judgmental, it's about making judgments. I like to look at what works for people. And I've looked at my own experience and asked myself, what works for me? And it strikes me that there's a few different levels of recovery. You come in and you can go to loads of meetings, which is fantastic. And if you go to loads of meetings, you'll get a place to belong, you'll get loads of new friends. Go to enough meetings, you probably get and stay clean. Brilliant. You can go to meetings, get those things, maybe get some service. You get that great freedom of transcending yourself, that freedom to be of service to another human being. So you can go to meetings, you can get some service, go to meetings, get some service, get a sponsor. Choose maybe for the first time in your life a free relationship in which you're picking the other person, and that other person, maybe if you're lucky, if they're the right person, can give you wisdom, guidance, unconditional love. So you can go to meetings, you can get this great new place to belong, you can get to stay clean, you can get some service, get to transcend yourself, get a sponsor, get that wonderful, durable relationship that is the heartbeat of this fellowship. Fantastic. I have to tell you, my experience is you can do all three of those things, but if you don't work the steps in tandem with it, it will be like watching your recovery in black and white on a TV with bad reception. That's my experience. The difference between recovery with the steps and recovery without the steps is the difference between watching that fuzzy picture flicker on that TV or running out of your house in the morning and plunging into the ocean. The steps are a mysterious alchemy. God knows how they came to be the way they are, but it is something that's beyond any individual. And it was only through the process of working through the steps, actually more than once, that different stuff was revealed to me. The first time I got to my step 8 and my step 9, I discovered something that I was completely and totally unaware of. A very important fact about me, and that fact was that I still had hatred in my heart. I still had a black stone of hatred in my heart. And that affected all of my human relationships. And that hatred was for men that raped me as an adult and a particular individual who had sexually abused me for a long time as a child. And that hatred was a very powerful attachment. Hatred is as powerful an attachment as love. It draws you to the object that you feel it for. I only came across this when I looked at that question that says, what would get in the way of me making these amends? Not because I thought I owed these men amends, I didn't and I still don't, but it was something about the idea of seeking other people's forgiveness that brought all this stuff to the fore. So I went to my sponsor, who God knows came from a dark place herself and knew a lot about kind of recovering from trauma, and I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this because this hatred I feel in my heart blocks me from being able to reach out to other people in that way. She said, you're going to make the amends and we'll talk about how you feel at the end of it. Okay. So I did that. So I paid the money back and I wrote the letters and I tried to make my peace with the people on my list who were dead. I did what I could to make my amends. And I remember the night I left my sponsor's house in Brighton, the kind of session when she said to me, right, okay, you've done enough step 9 now, it's time to move on to step 10. And it was a beautiful night and I walked down to the seaside in Brighton and it was big full moon, big silvery full moon, indigo sky, very still, silvery sea, and I stood by that sea, and for the first time in my life on this planet, I was free, utterly, completely, totally free to be myself, without hatred, without shame, without blame. I was just in my own skin, and only my own skin. And that's a greater freedom than I could ever, ever have thought possible. From that freedom have come so many others. What it gave me was the freedom to love, to give and receive love more fully. And that just has transformed everything. Now when I look at my family, I don't see the sick people caricatures that I'd spent my life blaming in my addiction. I honour them. They're imperfect. They've got their own problems. But they've done their best by me. I honour them as my family. And one of the themes of this convention is friendship, isn't it? And I've been so blessed with that. We all have, I guess. But I mean, I've had friends give me a roof when I didn't have a roof over my head in early recovery. I've had people feed me when I didn't have any money. I've had people sit by my bedside when I was ill. People take me backwards and forwards to hospital. And I've had a chance to be there for them in those ways as well. That's such a marvellous thing, and it's so completely the antidote to what we had in our using. And I am currently in a relationship with a man, and to me it feels like a healthy and a loving relationship, which given my background is kind of a miracle really. And for me also it's a relationship of equals. It's not based on dependence, it's not based on compulsion. I feel very lucky to have this man in my life. He's a man that combines great strength with great tenderness, and I honour him. And I've moved beyond the need to blame any gender for my suffering. We are all human, and that's what unites us. I was sitting with him the other day. I was on the North Welsh coast, a very beautiful place called Black Rock Sands, which is this headland of rock that juts out into the sea, and we were sitting there, and it was briefly and unseasonably warm for England, so we just had t-shirts on and everything. It was very exciting, and we were sitting with our backs to the rock and just feeling the warmth of the rock and watching the breeze ruffle the grass and looking out at the sea, and there was just a mass, like here really, this mass of silver gold movement. And what I felt in that moment was that I was in the right place with the right person at the right time, and I felt complete and utter peace and stillness. And that wouldn't be possible, even for a second, without the message of Narcotics Anonymous and what the steps have done for me, for all of us. And I have hope that more moments like that will be revealed to me. I mean, life is complicated. Life has suffering attached to it. This is a given, but it also has moments like that. And one of my great hopes in the program is that it's a spiral, not a linear path. It's not like, wow, a straight line, I've worked the steps, now I'm better. Right, that's it, what happens next? It's a spiral. You always keep coming back to yourself. Recovery is an unexplored country full of mystery. There's always something else to learn. And that's a marvellous thing. That's a marvellous thing. And yet, somehow, that is inextricably linked with our responsibility. I mean, I don't know why. I went for 20 years in my using thinking that freedom was about having no limits. No, with freedom comes responsibility. And if you look around the world and you see what people have to endure when they fight for their freedom, the basic freedoms, to clean water, to worship how they choose, to vote, you watch what people go through for that. How could I have ever thought that my addiction was going to be solved without me taking responsibility, without me struggling for that? And for me, that responsibility is to carry the message that nobody, anywhere, need die of this disease. There is a simple, practical alternative here, and we've all got it. Isn't that amazing? Everybody in this room is capable of saving another human being's life. Not because you're doctors or paramedics or we've got expert training, but because we reach into our hearts, we use our own experience, and we carry this message. Everybody in this room is capable of saving another human being's life. And unless everybody in this room wants to save another human's life, this fellowship will not thrive. Solid and self-assured as it looks, existed for 50 years, blink of an eye in historical time. 50 years from now, they may look back at us and say, thank God they kept their nerve, thank God they kept opening these meetings in places where there were no meetings, thank God they kept their home groups going. They may look at us and say, thank God that they reached out their hands to us over time so addicts could continue to recover from this disease. And think about my little meetings in the northeast of England. I mean, honestly, if we get six of us, we feel really, really lucky, yeah? So it would be me, two other kind of service diehards. There'll be the literature on the table, there'll be the mad newcomer, another mad newcomer if we're lucky. But it only takes one. It only takes one newcomer to walk in the door and to hear the same message that I was given when I walked in. Keep coming back, you're in the right place. And a human life can be utterly and totally transformed. Oh, I don't know who's familiar with the story of Pandora. Yeah, it's a Greek myth. And there's this chick called Pandora, using an Americanism there. Did you notice the way I just slipped it in? You wouldn't know I was from the UK, would you? There's this chick, right, yeah? Called Pandora. And there's a box in front of her. And somebody said to her, Pandora, whatever you do, don't open the bloody box. So naturally, Pandora opens the box. And out of the box flies all the things that we struggle with. Death, war, disease, famine, all these things fly out of the box and infect humanity. And she's sitting by the box and she's utterly broken at what she's done. She's got her head in her hands. And the last silvery little creature to climb out of the box says, Pandora, I'm the last thing in the box and I'm hope. And I'm going to give you what you need to endure all of this stuff. It's a great story. It's a very misogynist story, and I'm completely with Pandora. If somebody put a box in front of me and said, don't open the box, the first thing I would do as soon as their back is turned is open the box, of course. Who wouldn't? But the point is, without hope, we don't thrive, we don't grow, we don't prosper, we don't recover. And another nice image my sponsor gave me, and I've got a great sponsor and I've got great sponsees, and that relationship is core to my recovery, is that of a minefield. But we come into recovery and we face this minefield, and it's mined with our character defects and our pain and our fear and our compulsions and all of that stuff. And that unless another human being traces their footsteps back through their own minefield and reaches out their hand, we are unlikely to be able to cross that minefield. We're unlikely to be able to move on into recovery. And here we are. Every one of us in this room has their own minefield, has their own pain, has their own set of stuff that they've survived despite all the odds. Everybody in this room is a miracle. If you counted up the number of times all of us should be dead and added it up, you'd come up with an astronomical figure. Everybody in this room has this precious gift. Just like that silvery creature that came out of Pandora's box, we've all got this gift, and it's hope. And our hope is our message, and our message is universal, and it's simple. No addict need die of this disease, because there is an organisation called Narcotics Anonymous that has a simple, a practical programme of recovery that any addict can work. There are no exemption clauses there, unlike some other people. There's no constitutionally incapable. Any addict that wants to recover can recover. Any addict that wants not to live in despair, with death, with betrayal, any addict that chooses to move forward can recover. And that's what we've got here. And that's what I got here. And that's what I got for free. That happened to me once, you know. I was actually speaking and my mobile phone rang. It was really bad. And it wasn't even for me. It was the wrong number. So I just want to say that I think everybody in this room is a remarkable miracle. And I also think you're quite remarkable because you've listened to me talk for bloody ages. Nearly everybody is still awake. So thank you, and I hope the light shines on you. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Well done.
Well, thanks for participating in recovery with us in this room today. And can we give one more hand to Sean for sharing? Clearly, the message of recovery is alive and well on the
the Garden Isle of UK. let's see. I think I've asked Remy to come up and read just for today.
Well, my name is Howard. I'm a recovering addict.
Thank you, Howard.
From Oakland, California.
All right. Once again, my name is Howard. I'm an addict. Just for today, tell yourself, just for today, my thoughts would be on my recovery, living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. Just for today, I would have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery. Just for today, I would have a program. I would try to follow it to the best of my ability. Just for today, through NA, I would try to get a better perspective on my life. Just for today, I will be unafraid. My thoughts would be on my new associations, people who are not using and who have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear. Doesn't say all that.
So with that, we'll make a big circle here. Probably won't go all the way around the room and close with the reversion of the third step prayer.